Welcome to New Books in Politics on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Bill Scher. Today we are joined by the author of a great new book chronicling the rise of the new left. We've got people from Jesse Jackson to AOC, the end of big money and the rise of a movement. He is the DC bureau chief of The Intercept. Thanks for being on the show, Ryan Grimm.
Oh, thanks a ton for having me.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about, since the Bernie Sanders primary challenge in 2016 did much better than expected, the upset win by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, how that's impacted the House Democratic Caucus, how it's impacted the 2020 Democratic primary. There's been a lot of chatter about that, but in this book, you do some deeper reporting into how this movement came into being. What did you find that wasn't already known by your average news consumer?
Well, so I had been covering this, this tension between the left and the center left of the party, basically since 2006, when I was assigned to write about those midterms, the Rahm Emanuel 2006 midterms. And so while very few people were paying attention to the simmering battle for a good reason, it was basically my job to watch it on a day in, day out basis and report on it. And the good reason that people weren't necessarily paying close attention to it is that in my book, the protagonists of the fight were too weak to matter much. You had Howard Dean, before 2006, you had Howard Dean in 2003 and 2004, make a run at the presidency. And, that's kind of in the internet era, that's kind of the first blip of the rise of this movement. But after that, you don't really see much until kind of Sanders again. And so in that interregnum, it doesn't mean that they weren't fighting. It just means that they were losing constantly.
Now, you made the interesting choice to begin this narrative with the Jesse Jackson campaigns of 84 and 88. And sometimes you will hear, I think Barack Obama said something along the lines of, without Jesse Jackson, we build on his success. But his campaigns didn't win. He had a vision. Right. Of marrying African Americans with white workers that didn't quite make it. Is it just simply that he had a vision that is catching on now, or did people like Bernie Sanders and like Ocasio-Cortez and others recognize here's what he didn't do correctly and here's how we improved upon what he did?
Right. And on your first point, like from a factual basis, and Jesse Jackson's very proud of this. The changes that he didn't win, like you said, the pressure that he brought to bear on the party led to some significant rules changes around how delegates are selected and how presidents are nominated in the party. And without those rule changes, Hillary Clinton wins the 2008 nomination. I think that's a fairly uncontroversial statement, right? That because they went more or less from winner take all to proportional, that's what allowed Obama to rack up his delegate lead. So in that sense, Obama was standing on his shoulders. But to your other point, yes, the folks like Bernie Sanders who endorsed Jesse Jackson's campaign and Ocasio-Cortez, that is the same coalition that they envision, a progressive populist majoritarian coalition that combines white working class voters, black working class voters, brown working class voters, along with other progressive whites and other elements of the Democratic coalition.
I want to delve into this a little bit more, but I want to perhaps bring in another element of your narrative in it before I do that. Mm-hmm. You have a part of the book where you talk about how the Democratic diagnosis of presidential failures of the 80s was that the party had gone too left, that liberalism was being blamed. This really culminated with the Dukakis campaign, where George H.W. Bush, you know, used liberal as a real overt slur, and Dukakis was really staggered by that. You may not know, I wrote a book in 2006 that actually made a similar point, because I think, as you say in your book, Walter Mondale wasn't running as a loud and proud liberal. He was running as a bit of a deficit hawk, and turning away from certain traditional liberal positions. Although, because he ran on raising taxes, that was seen as the big liberal thing that he did, even though it was in the name of deficit reduction. So what do you think was the wrong lesson that Democrats learned from the failures of the 80s? And what has that been corrected since? Do Democrats now have a much more open embrace of liberalism, or is that debate still something that Democrats are not in consensus about?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. They're not in consensus about it. And I think a lot of the resistance you see to a more openly progressive agenda comes from people who lived through that that period of the 80s and early 90s and convinced themselves that they live in a center right party. It's a conservative country. I mean, they live in a conservative country, and that they have to moderate their tone. Otherwise, they're going to get tossed out like they did back in the 80s. But now I've got to go back and read your 2006 book. That sounds quite good. But the way that I think about it and write about it in the book is, and I draw on some political science literature that has gone back and looked at the drift that the party made kind of to the right into corporate interests, and drift is an interesting way of thinking about it, because there were people who were making the explicit argument, Tony Coelho being the loudest voice of them in the early 1980s.
He was a California Democratic consultant.
Congressman, California Democratic Congressman, now a consultant,
right? Yes.
And he became DCCC chair after the 1980 cycle, on the argument that Democrats needed a PAC strategy. They needed to do better with corporate fundraising, because his argument was, we lost in 1980 because Republicans figured out television, and they figured out big fundraising, and they figured out the 30-second attack ad and how to play dirty. There's a nice section of that in that masterpiece documentary on Roger Stone. Get me Roger Stone. And how much credit you give to Stone is totally beside the point, but they did absolutely learn how to go dirty in 1980. And so Democrats said, well, this is what we need to just match them dollar for dollar, rather than taking kind of a longer view and thinking like, okay, the coalitions are realigning here. So what is the way that we get to, what's the argument that we make that forms a majoritarian coalition? That was cut off by the need to raise for this PAC strategy that they developed.
So is the point there that the real reason Democrats were getting beat in the 80s was not that Carter, Mondale, Dukakis was too far to the left, but it was that Republicans had a more sinister and hardball strategy, or is there overlap between the two? They had a hardball strategy. That strategy was paint Democrats as too far to the left.
Right. That's exactly right. Like they would use their 30-second ads for that, and also, for other, personal attacks. The quote politics of personal destruction, really start coming into play there. And Republicans get very good over the years, at disqualifying particular candidates, rather than fighting it out on an ideological terrain. And so Democrats felt like they needed to figure out how to do that to counteract what Republicans were up to. And on the drift side of it, they were casting about for, the best source of this money that would not, be an immediate confrontation with their coalition. And so, for instance, you don't really want auto executive money if if you're still, you know, aligned very closely with the UAW. The same could be true of some, you know, some of the environmental elements of the party and oil money. And so at the time, one of the most inoffensive sources of capital was Wall Street, because Wall Street wasn't what it is today. You know, it was a much sleepier industry that was, you know, more of a utility to the economy than it was the actual entire engine of the economy. And so people didn't have an aversion to it. It was before the S&L crisis, and there weren't really any major elements of the Democratic coalition that were repulsed by the idea of Democrats getting money from major financial institutions. And so they just gradually started taking more and more of that. And the next thing you know, it's becoming a dominant force in the party.
Let's dig into that tension between the corporate wing and the grassroots wing in just a little bit. But just to further this ideological thread, Bill Clinton wins in 92, running as a third way candidate, intentionally pushing off of the left. And so that becomes part of the narrative that Democrats went too far to the left in the 80s. Clinton solved that problem. Right. By being a moderate. The point that that I made in my old book was that that didn't definitively prove that you could not win with a right. more liberal agenda. Right. And then seemingly Barack
Jerry
Obama
probably wins that election, right? What do you think?
That's a good question. You know, Clinton, you know, I've argued that, you know, Ross Perot drew from both Clinton and Bush. And, you know, Steve Kornacki is the most famous person making that argument, but I've made that argument as well. And part of the people that Perot got were disaffected Jerry Brown and Paul Tsongas voters who couldn't really cotton to Bill Clinton. So if you had a Jerry Brown there with a more fire-breathing populist message, does he do even better than Bill Clinton? Because you don't lose that chunk of the party. But then of course, the converse is what Brown might have gotten, would he have lost something else? Would he even seen as too far left and lost more of the middle of the Bush? It's hard to fully
right.
game out. But to skip ahead, you know, Barack Obama wins running, you know, much less like a centrist, much less like a triangulator, wins pretty convincingly. And that seems to suggest, okay, you don't need to run as a third way candidate anymore. But Barack Obama doesn't run quite like a Jesse Jackson, at least right. at least coalitionally. He gets the African-American vote and gets upscale white liberals and gets, you know, at least a chunk of the white working class. Doesn't win it outright, but gets does okay. And that's how he pulls it off. So right. when you go now to Bernie doesn't do the same thing. He tries, but he gets the white left vote in the primary, but he doesn't get the African-American vote. So how do you take Jesse to Obama to Bernie and say, okay, how does one get to the Obama place where you actually put together the full coalition?
Someone like Ocasio-Cortez, mm-hmm. you know, you need to take into account the demographics. White Jesse Jackson does not do as well. You know, in 1988, I mean, they're like the idea of a white Jesse Jackson is silly, you know, because he is a civil rights leader. But you know what I mean? Like, so you need, and Ocasio-Cortez talked about this in a podcast at The Intercept, actually, where she said, like, when she first launched her campaign on a, you know, straight up and down, you know, far progressive platform, it was doing well, and she had she had some base of support from progressives in the district. But when she, you know, evolved her campaign to also bring in, her, you know, gender and race to it, that is what really fleshed out the candidacy. She says it much more eloquently in the interview than I did, but you need all of those different pieces, at this point to pull the coalition together, because there isn't a straight kind of class conscious majority coalition yet in the United States, and there may never be. And so you need to hit all those different elements of it.
It's to bring in the corporate piece of it. Barack Obama runs, you know, symbolically, to some extent, superficially, more to the left than past Democrats had. But he also gets a lot of money from Wall Street. Right. He does. I mean, he has a very robust small dollar operation, but he also gets the big money too. And this, to this day, completely irritates the left, who says that that compromised Obama from the beginning. But it is how Obama, it helped Obama win and made sure he wasn't outspent. And then you get into the very big debate. Was his agenda progressive enough, or was it insufficiently progressive? But it certainly got him elected twice. So why should the new left be so horrified at the idea that you can have both small donors and big donors in the same coalition?
So I think they're, you know, you're not going to, in the short term, get rid of big donors completely anyway. But if the big donors want to participate, I would say that the place for them in a more functioning kind of social democratic party would be in doing in building and maintaining the infrastructure of the party, in funding Acorn-like organizations who are doing, you know, community work, doing voter registration, building the capacity of the party rather than directly financing candidates. And so that would mean you're only getting kind of ideological big money. If there are a lot of, because we have a lottery based, economy, you wind up with lots of people getting lucky and becoming millionaires and billionaires. A chunk of those are just, you know, left liberal people who are just ideologically left and want to support left politics. And, you know, if they want to do that, then, you know, the way that Tom Steyer registered so many voters for Andrew Gillum in Florida seems like the most useful marriage of those ideas. But the small dollar operation on a national level has gotten to the place where it may have been tactically required in 2008 to go dollar for dollar with John McCain, but it wouldn't be now. Like if Barack Obama, or if actually Barack Obama, ran in 2020 or 2024, he could raise, $500 million or more, probably $1 billion, just in small contributions. And so if you can do that, then why? Like, what does it bring to the coalition to have that element of the party in it?
So just to be transparent, I've skidded in this debate. I've written some articles for Politico and Real Clear Politics on the subject, where I take the very obnoxious pro corporate donor side, which means we have many friends and colleagues. And I had a debate recently with Cenk Uygur at the Young Turks, who took issue with one of my pieces. And one thing that we had a different interpretation on was Elizabeth Warren's posture in the 2020 primary, and we're recording in the spring of 2019. And Warren has made a big show at not doing any fundraising events, not doing any personal meetings with big donors. It's strictly small donors, and so she's openly admitting, "I'm leaving some money on the table by doing that." But she also says, "If I get the nomination, then I would do that. I'm not gonna unilaterally disarm against the Republican nominee." And my interpretation of that is she's acknowledging that she can take that money without diluting her agenda. Her agenda is what it is, and if you're giving to her, you know that going in. You might be trying to persuade her. You might be trying to get a seat at the table to push her away from it. But at the end of the day, she gets to make the call what her position is going to be. And Cenk was more, I love Elizabeth Warren. I don't think she should have done that. I think the money is inherently corrupting. I trust her to resist it, but I still don't think that changes my view on what that money represents. So where do you think the rising progressive movement views that? I mean, obviously the general sense is the money is inherently corrupting, but is there wiggle room a la Elizabeth Warren to say, you know what, we got to beat Trump and whatever it's going to take, we have to do it.
Right. I mean, there might be, but it would be the exception that would kind of prove the rule. And you don't really want to rely systematically on the willpower and the backbone of a progressive, you know, presidential nominee. Now, if we wound up with a situation where the Democratic Party had actually nominated Elizabeth Warren, and she, you know, she knows she already has a network of high net worth people who have donated to her in the past, who I would say fit in that definition of the kind of ideological donor. Like, these are not people. Now, she's done some legislative work on behalf of medical device companies, on behalf of Bose, whose, you know, headquarters in Massachusetts, went to battle with hearing aid companies. So it's not like she doesn't, like, you know, pick out some special interests and get behind them in particular issues. But in general, I would suspect that most of those donors that she's talking about being willing to do dinners for in the general are kind of the ideological left donors who happen to be extremely rich people. And so it might be the case that in this one-off that Elizabeth Warren doesn't end up getting, corrupted one way or another by that process. But there's just no way you can kind of systematize that. In the long run, it's just inherently corrupting. And maybe she's underestimating the amount of small dollars that she could raise against Trump from, July through November.
We're talking with Ryan Grimm here on the New Books in Politics podcast, the author of We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement, published by Strong Arm Press, which is your own brainchild, correct?
Yeah, Alex Lawson and I launched that a couple of years ago. Amazon's utter annihilation of the industry makes it much easier for small publishers to come in now.
Now, as part of this book, you do some digging into what happened in the Obama administration and how that informs how this new rising progressive movement sees what they believe needs to be done going forward. There's not blind love to the Obama administration on the left. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say.
So what did you dig up in your reporting that you don't think is widely known?
Well, what I think is most interesting to people today is, and I went back and talked to a bunch of people who were involved in Organizing for America, which was his grassroots operation that came out of his campaign. And involved in the early decisions around strategically how to confront Washington. And, you can imagine that there are two ways that you barrel into Washington coming out of the 2008 presidential campaign with nearly a million jobs a month being lost, unemployment creeping above 12%, the country in free fall, and pundits talking openly about what kind of party is going to replace the GOP. You know, the Democrats were in an extraordinary and an extraordinary delicate moment. And so you can either take all of this historic energy that you've built up in 2008 and try to go for broke, tell your supporters, that you're basically want them to form what Indivisible became in 2017, show up at town halls, or what the Tea Party became in summer 2009, show up at town halls, call your member of Congress, bird dog them at events, tell them that, the stimulus needs to be, $3 trillion over the next 3 years, or, whatever the number they need to come in at. that they want to do, you know, robust healthcare reform. That's a time to do climate change through reconciliation. Legislation is right now. You barrel into town and you try to change the dynamics that way, which you know, pushes people like Arlen Specter and Libby Snow and Susan Collins.
The moderate Republicans of the time.
Right.
Although Specter then flipped after the Recovery Act vote.
It shows that he was pressurable. He became a Democrat. And so, or you rely on the goodwill of the Republicans to come to a reasonable compromise in this great time of need. And the same with the Blue Dogs and the New Democrats, the twin conservative factions within the House caucus. You sit down with them and you ask them what they need, what they think their districts require them to do. And you play kind of an inside game. And he went that route. And I think the consequences were that the Tea Party was emboldened and that that eventually, the movement towards Trump, develops out of that anger that was never, quite dealt with.
I like my sense of the new left critique of Obama is that it was half measures. It didn't fully resolve the pain caused by the economic crisis of 2008, that anger fueled the Tea Party, eventually fueled the rise of Donald Trump. It led to disastrous midterms in 2010 and 2014. And therefore, you need to have a more robust left populism to avoid those problems and have a sustainable majority. And it seems in my mind that narrative is complicated.
Well, let me stop you
with
one clarification.
Yep.
I don't necessarily think doing everything you said would guarantee a sustainable majority. I think that we're in a period where, for the foreseeable future, where the elections are going to whipsaw back and forth. And you're going to see wave after wave. There's been a wave since 2006. Almost every election has been a wave. At some point, you have to stop calling them waves, which is elections. As long as the parties are in flux and people are so angry, you're going to see people washed out. And so I think the Republican response to that reality was, okay, we've got 2 years. Let's do everything we can. Now, they failed to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But going into the midterms, nobody would have told them that the best, the smartest thing for you right now, is to, do a $6 trillion tax cut and blow up, a home mortgage deduction when you're trying to hold on to all these suburban districts. And instead, they said, well, what's more important to us, holding the house or $6 trillion in tax cuts? And they chose the $6 trillion in tax cuts. And so the flip side would be, well, Democrats, if they're going to get swept out eventually anyway, do the most popular thing that you can do and get it in place so that when you do lose power, it stays in place like the Affordable Care Act did. So then the question becomes, what's the goal of party politics? Is it for the party to stay in power, or is it to create public policy that benefits the coalition represented by that party?
So do you think, that was a very clear-eyed strategy going forward, not expecting to win in perpetuity, get what you can while you got the power.
Right, and don't design your coalition to just try to cling to power.
Do you think that is the common belief amongst the activist leaders and the political, the more left office holders that you have spoken with for this book? Do they think this is about surviving in a polarized, pendulum swinging environment, or do they believe if they got this agenda passed in their first 2 years, it would be so popular that they would keep winning elections?
Right. Not many people agree with me on this. So, Michael Podhorns who's very smart analyst and strategist.
Audio cut a little bit there. Can you repeat that last couple sentences?
So I'm in the minority on this one. Michael Podhorzer, who is a very smart strategist at the AFL-CIO, is one of the few people I've interviewed who kind of agree with this whipsaw pendulum idea. But generally, when I talk to the activists and progressive legislators about this, they would rather believe that progressive ideas are so popular that if you can implement them, then the people are going to reward you at the next election because they're so popular. And I can say, well, they can be popular, but that doesn't mean that the party itself can become unpopular through events that had nothing to do with the party. Let's say there's a BP oil spill in the Gulf that is really pissing people off, and it comes right before the election. Or you have an Ebola outbreak and ISIS sweeping across Iraq, which neither of those forces can be necessarily controlled, planned for, or put at the feet of a single person or party or another. Yet whoever's in power at that moment is going to bear the brunt of the criticism from voters. And I don't think that a lot of activists have internalized that or want to believe that, because I think it's probably much more comforting to think that, well, if I can run on, implement popular policies, then I'll be popular and I'll stay in power. And in a functioning system, you would think that is how it would be, but that, that's asking a bit much.
Well, here's why I think the Affordable Care Act is an interesting case study, because here is a law that was fueled by a grassroots push. There was the Healthcare for America Now coalition that really beat the drums for healthcare and made it kind of a necessity. The Democrats couldn't go to voters in 2010 and say, sorry, got nothing here.
Funded by big money.
Well, which
goes to my other point.
Right.
Like, that's an okay place for some big money.
So, and there were partnerships between groups like Families USA, which is a consumer healthcare consumer operation, partnering with Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical lobby, and they plowed a ton of money into, they brought back the Harry and Louise actors from the Clinton and the Hillary care debacle when the pharmaceutical companies, lambasted that with this Harry and Louise ad campaign. They brought those actors back for pro-Obamacare ads. Pharmaceuticals get a sweetheart deal in the bill. This really irritates the left. This says this shows why this whole system is corrupt and flawed. But at the same time, you have some corporate buy-in in the bill that makes it harder to repeal root and branch once they do lose power. You had a healthcare company saying to the Trump administration and the House Republicans, don't repeal this. This is going to make everything go haywire. Right. Don't do this. So is there a benefit at getting that buy-in? If the pendulum is going to keep swinging back and forth, some force needs to be around for continuity's sake. Does having corporate buy-in for liberal policies help with that?
Yeah, well, it can. And so, it also helped that lots of, 20 plus million people had health care. So you had regular people who didn't want it repealed. And then you had industry who was warning of, a catastrophe. Let's say they could put a Green New Deal or some type of major climate change legislation into place. That creates entire new corporate sectors or buttresses them. Like, Republicans ideologically would have loved to get rid of the solar panel credits, when they were in power and they had the power to do it, and they left the credits in place. And that's not because big oil was all of a sudden okay with having solar based competition, but it was because there are probably more solar jobs in West Virginia now than coal jobs. It's become an industry, in the sense that it has both voters and donors. So I do think it's smart to think about what constituencies you're creating with policy, so that those constituencies then defend the policy when you're inevitably cast in the minority.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you is, what does 2018 say about where this movement, what the prospects of this new progressive movement? So we had a narrative from elements of the left saying that this long history of democratic accommodation with corporate interests and centrism, it was disastrous for Democrats in 2010 and 2014. It was disastrous, it was especially disastrous in 2016 with Hillary losing to Donald Trump, who outflanked her on populism. And we have the example of Ocasio-Cortez, of course, which is now a new leader for this movement. But most Democrats that got elected in 2018 were not in the Ocasio-Cortez mold. They were more like, you know, a Dean Phillips, who was in a suburban district in Minnesota, or you certain outlier examples like Joe Cunningham in South Carolina won. You have a lot of folks that ran on. I mean, there were certain populist elements, like, you know, the Republican corporate tax cuts are bad. Republicans want to take away your health care. But it wasn't single payer. It wasn't Green New Deal. It was a lot of, you know, Washington dysfunction. Washington's not working.
A lot of them did run on. A lot of them did run on Medicare for All. Who ended up flipping a lot of districts.
Less so in the Trump won districts. So you Clinton won districts that Republican held. You had more Medicare for All folks in the redder districts. That wasn't as much the case.
Right. But so the suburban sweep certainly wasn't slowed by people who supported Medicare for All. And you had a couple, Katie Porter is a good example of somebody who won there. But I think that, like, reading my book, people would not be terribly surprised that there wasn't more of a robust left, because these things don't just come from nowhere. And it was a skeleton for so long. The movement was such a skeleton for so long that, the infrastructure wasn't really there to match the energy. And so the moment couldn't quite be realized. It is true that, like, the DCCC style candidates, more often than not won their primaries against the progressive in the race. And the progressive didn't really have the firepower and didn't have the kind of social base that was going to put them over the top. That tends not to be a thing that exists in a lot of these districts around the country.
So is there, what I'm curious is there any kind of strategic recalibration on the left because of that? I saw immediately after the midterm election, Sean McElwee at Data for Progress, who's one of the intellectual architects behind the new left, he seemed to acknowledge, people like Ocasio-Cortez are our future. We need to build power in the deep blue districts. We're having better luck there than in the Trump won district. So let's focus on that to build our numbers. Is that the prevailing view, or is there still a high level of confidence that this agenda has salience regardless of geographics and demographics, and so we just need to double down and triple down and not worry about the fact that people who are relatively moderate won certain races in 2018?
That does seem to be the direction that groups like Justice Democrats, have taken. And not necessarily because they don't think that they can't win in swing districts, but that they have limited resources at this point. And so the thinking is, okay, look at the radical shift in the conversation just by getting Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley into Congress, Katie Porter. I would actually include in that, though she doesn't fit because she's not a deep blue district. But you focus there, and then you get the entire country and the whole caucus talking about a Green New Deal because you've got a new power center in these strong blue districts, and then that should that should then influence the politics of the swing districts. Like that's the kind of theory. And I think that's okay, but it doesn't, it's not a substitute for also organizing in those swing districts.
What do you think about the impact of the Green New Deal and more broadly, to abolish ICE happened before Green New Deal. There was a big push for abolish ICE in 2018. It made a lot of noise for a few weeks. The Republicans did a disingenuous...
And it surged with the caging of children.
Right,
coming up
right. Yeah. So, you know, I wrote a piece about this where I was arguing Democrats were united around don't cage children. They were united around pathway to citizenship. They were not united around abolish ICE. And so... when that gets forced onto the floor by Republicans to try to embarrass Democrats, Democrats run away from abolish ICE. They don't vote for that resolution. And abolish ICE tends to fizzles out as a talking point. Green New Deal is having a bit more resonance than abolish ICE has, even though Republicans did the same move. They took the Ocasio-Cortez resolution. Mm-hmm. They threw it on the Senate floor. Democrats did not vote for it. And so you're not seeing the presidential candidates on the Democratic side run on the literal text of the Green New Deal resolution. They're not taking all of the elements. They're using the slogan. They're working within mm-hmm. the framework. So you could say, well, we have achieved an Overton window success. We have pushed the debate in our direction. Even if we're not getting exactly what we want, we're better than we were before. Are folks left taking that victory, or are they saying, look, if Joe Biden comes out with a plan for net zero emissions by 2050, the plan is fried in 12 years, that's still not good enough, and I'm not happy. Do you think their agenda is more Overton window, or is it to win the literal policy proposals that are maximalist and absolutist?
Well, both. And Sunrise really beat up Beto O'Rourke when he came out with a really strong plan. And in the wake of that, they did a lot of kind of self-criticism over their response to it, and saying that, yeah, look, we want the strongest possible, but we were too critical on that because it is a well thought out and legitimate plan that we want to give real credit to O'Rourke for putting out there. And so you're seeing them grow and mature as they're evolving as an organization.
They're gentler to Biden, even though like Biden's plan is somewhat similar to Biden.
Yeah, right? And that was a direct result of their reflection on their reaction to O'Rourke. So they look at Biden putting out a very strong plan, and they see it as a significant win. In a shift of the Overton window, and in like just the idea that he put one out at all when it appeared like he wasn't going to, but they're still critical. You know, their response was, "This is a great plan." On the other hand, you still have, you know, it was written by somebody who was on the board of a natural gas company, and you're still taking fossil fuel money, and it should be more ambitious, but it's very good, and so they're trying to. Use both carrots and sticks.
So just to wrap things up, what do you think people, when people read your book, when people read We've Got People, what's their big takeaway going to be?
Well, it's been fun to watch people read it and get their takeaway because, you know, you're never sure exactly what. And the main takeaway from people I've been meeting around the country who read it, and I'm so flattered that people actually have read it because it's like 400 pages and I can't get people to read past the third paragraph of a lot of stories. and it's becoming clear that people are actually reading it. That just makes it all worth doing. They keep asking, why won't Democrats just fight? That seems to be a main takeaway that these particular activists / readers, that they want a party that's going to fight for them. And they understand that you're going to lose some fights, but what they can't get their head around is the lack of the fight and finding kind of the energy and the motivation for a fight when it's against the left within the party. That doesn't seem, they don't seem to have a problem knowing how to go to war, but they tend to direct their sharpest attacks, you know, internally in the caucus, and so people are like, why won't they just go after Republicans with this ferocity? And I think a lot of that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the 1980s, the trauma associated with, you know, liberalism, you know, them believing that liberalism was getting tossed out, and a lot of people who are, you know, newer to politics, you know, just didn't go through that formative experience, and so they're not afraid of the Republican Party in the way that the older generation is.
The book is We've Got People, from Jesse Jackson to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement, published by Strong Arm Press. Ryan Grimm, thanks so much for being on New Books in Politics.
Thanks, Bill.